What a mature way to pray together as a church, that we would be still and trust Him. Before I engage, I need to move the pine wood boxes. I love our church, even fun things like that we can do together, serious things like the word, and even the somber tone of the service. Sometimes the highest heights precipitated by the lowest lows. And we want to capture the whole range of that experience, especially as we're working our way through the Psalms, which seem to do that very well. A note of triumph in many ways last week in Psalm 30, but one largely marked by tragedy here in Psalm 31. Please turn with me there. And we'll look at the entire chapter, but if you're not there yet, be warned, it's rather long, at least compared to the other ones. 24 verses, and I think the best way for us to engage with it is to work through it. And so I'll just read the opening two verses to get us started, and then I'll read the rest of the text through the exposition. Psalm 31, beginning in verses 1 and 2. To the choir master, a psalm of David. In you, O Lord, do I take refuge. Let me never be put to shame. In your righteousness, deliver me. Incline your ear to me. Rescue me speedily. Be a rock of refuge for me, a strong fortress to save me. A few months ago, I was introduced to a term, a phrase that I had never heard before. And at first hearing, it didn't make much sense. But as tends to happen, through months of marinating on it, I agree. The sociologist was trying to point out this phenomenon that he called the paradox of a safe society. The paradox of a safe society. And the argument is intriguing. Basically, what he's trying to point out is that in the modern Western world, in which we actually have more physical protections than we've ever had, and more physical possessions than we've ever had, people actually experience more anxiety and fear than they ever have. It's the paradox of the safe society. Basically, the more you have, the more you're afraid of losing it. The more safe you are physically, the more freed up you are to be concerned about things emotionally and internally. I mean, this is reflected in just the normal experience of most people's working day. Like, they wake up concerned about whether or not they got enough sleep. Interestingly, the rise of sleep tracking apps has actually harmed people's sleep. And then they get to breakfast. And then there's the debate about breakfast. Is this healthy? Is this good for my heart? What if I eat fast carbs here? Is this going to tank my metabolism? Is this going to produce insulin? People are worried about not having enough healthy fats, or then eating too many carbs, or how do I get in enough protein? Because it's really expensive. So you've just made it through waking up. You've woken up, you've got anxiety, you just go to the breakfast table, you've got anxiety, and then you get in your car, and if you are so self-punishing as to keep it on talk radio, now you're getting the engineered anxiety of the entire world. Like, people never had access to all the terrible things that were going on in the world at one time, and now you do. And you get to listen to that all the way to work, all the way to dropping your kids off. And so it continues through the day. For some people, this is low grade and persistent, and yet for others, let's just take it a step further. There really are reasons to be concerned. There are acute anxieties over like the threats of life, the brokenness of this world. I just asked a guy this morning how he was doing, and with kind of like some shame, he's like, "Or one day closer." I felt bad. And I love him well, and he's not going to be embarrassed by this. But I felt bad about the interchange because he almost felt embarrassed not to say that I'm doing great. Friends, I hate to sound like a psychologist, but it's okay to not be okay. And this text will make that evidently clear. If you ever experience that acute anxiety or you know that it's got that low-grade hum in the background, friends, this song is for you. It's long, and it's meandering. Like, if you were to try to figure out, like, the one instance in David's life that's going down when he, like, wrote this, like, you won't find it because he appeals to everything. This is an anything and everything affliction kind of psalm. He meanders from like social pressure to like physical threats to emotional pressures to relational threats. I mean, like, it just goes all over the place. It really is a song of affliction. But it's not just affliction. Here's why I say this song is for you. It's not just about you. It is a song of assurance amid affliction. Note the pronoun. Assurance amid affliction, not assurance after affliction. But even in the midst of it, like the verses are actually like training you in how to experience assurance as a believer even when things are legitimately spinning out of control or seem to be a significant threat. So it's a song of assurance amid affliction. It's got three verses and a reprise. The three verses are admittedly a little contrived. I want to say this ahead of time. Because the text is so meandering, it's hard to actually, for anyone, frankly, to agree on the outline. But I have noticed a pattern here that I hope you'll see as well. There's three different movements in this text where David actually will like give a declaration of his dependence, and then he follows it with an expression of assurance. And then he moves to another area and gives a declaration of dependence and follows it with an expression of assurance. And then another area, same thing. And then this final summary at the end. So just note these more loosely than we would with the precision that we would normally try to do. Because of the emotional nature of the psalm, it doesn't actually fit into the logical confines that some of you would like it to fall in, which shows its beauty. But as you listen to these verses, as you take in the song, I trust that it'll strengthen your faith when your circumstances would say otherwise. Here's the first verse, assurance when hunted down. Assurance when hunted down. The second, just for you note takers, assurance when torn up. Assurance when torn up. And then the third is assurance when drowned out. Assurance when drowned out. Look at this first one. Notice this first verse about assurance when one is hunted down. Verses 1 through 4 and then verses 5 through 8. He says, "In you, O Lord, do I take refuge." So he's coming to God for refuge, for shelter, protection. "Let me never be put to shame." Whatever it is that's going to happen in David's life, he feels like this will bring about shame on the name of God. He is God's righteous representative. And for him, as the king of Israel, to suffer loss would be for God to suffer loss. He's a representative of the Lord on the planet. So he wants success not only for himself, but success as an emissary of God. And so he prays, "In your righteousness, deliver me. God does that which is right, and for David, in his mind, it would be right for him to be rescued, so he rightly prays, God, bail me out, rescue me. Incline your ear to me. Get close, listen. Rescue me speedily. Notice the urgency of this. This isn't long term. This is something that is immediate in the moment, like something that's threatening him right now, a pressure that's present. Be a rock of refuge for me, a strong fortress to save me. Notice that, a rock of refuge, a strong fortress. It's not only an immediate threat, but it is an intense threat. He doesn't just say, I need a shield. He says, I need a strong fortress. I need to be in a safe place. I'm under attack. For you are, verse 3, my rock and my fortress. And for your name's sake, you lead me and guide me. Here's the other thing I'll point out. When he feels hunted down, it's not just that he needs the defense, but he also needs direction. He needs a way out. He feels like as he makes his way forward that it's unsafe for him. He is indeed like someone who is being hunted down. I don't know if any of you remember as children reading that traumatic tale, Where the Red Fern Grows. The story of the boy and his dogs, and they're hunting fox, and so there's this amazing scene for the majority of us who have never hunted a fox, that they're so wily that there is a twofold approach. They send dogs to go after them, and they set traps to capture them. There's the passive and the aggressive. Now, I've never been hunted in such a way. But David here is expressing the kind of terms where he feels like he's being hunted down. He needs a safe spot, and then like the tree to run up in, if you will. He needs the safe spot, and then he's still got to go about his life somehow. Like he's still got to move forward. But he knows that there's traps everywhere. Friends, I don't know if you've ever felt this pressure where it just feels like people are after you, like they're out to get you. And even if you do find a safe place, you know that life's got to move on at some point. Like you've got to find a way forward. And what David's doing in both of these pressures, when he feels hunted down, is he's giving it up to the Lord and saying, like, I need you in this problem in particular. Notice he says in verse 4, you take me out of the net they have hidden for me, for you are my refuge. He knows that God can get him out of those problems as he tries to progress. And then these famous lines, into your hand I commit my spirit. Sound familiar? We just read those words a few moments ago, and we will revisit them again before the sermon concludes. But for this moment, I want you to know that these are some of the most popular lines in all the Bible, regularly used. Like when people are experiencing trouble, this is the song that's going through their head, and this is one of the most popular lines. God, when I feel hunted down, into your hands I commit my spirit. And why? Notice this. Into your hands I commit my spirit, because you have redeemed me. Oh, Lord, faithful God, covenant God. Like, remember, God on the first name basis, Jehovah, Yahweh. He's saying, you've entered into special relationship with me. You've redeemed me. You've bought me out of trouble. Like, I am owned by you. Friends, this gets us back to that famous catechism. What is our only hope in life and death? That we belong to God. Like, that is David's hope, even in this moment, that he belongs to God. He's been purchased by him. And for those of you who know the pressure of owning stuff, having spent money on something, like when you pay for it, you want to protect it. That's why all those people at Best Buy can make all that extra money off you with those protection plans. They're like, well, man, he's already spent, you know, $200 on this piece of technology. What's another, you know, $5 a month? Over the course of years, ending up being $120. I'm not your financial advisor. I'm not going to say whether or not you should do the protection plan. All I'm telling you is that the fact that you spent the money demands that you want to keep it. You want to protect it. The sales pitch wouldn't work if they didn't think that you valued what you bought. Friends, I want you to know that God values those whom he has purchased for himself. He is invested. He not only created, but he redeemed. And it wasn't just a couple hundred dollars. It was at the cost of his very own son. And so the psalmist, when hunted down, can actually commit his soul back to God, say, "You own me, I'm yours. Whatever you want to do with my life, it is up to you. I am in your hands." Even when hunted down. Like, God, in the end, you've got to do something because I am yours. This is no longer about me. Look at verse 6. David here is showing himself to be one who is actually deserving of God's favor, not on the basis of anything that he's done, but he puts himself in a different category from the everyday ordinary guy. God doesn't care for all people the same way. Notice how David puts it. "I hate those who pay regard to worthless idols, but I trust in the Lord." What's David doing? He's actually telling God, "I am one of the believers. I am one of the ones who is leaning in on you. I am one of the ones who trusts in you. I am not the ones who pay regard to the empties," literally. The word idol in Hebrew just means breath, wind, emptiness. Friends, David is drawing a contrast. There is a group of people out there who are absolutely devoted, hang on to this, to nothing. To nothing. Nothing of any substance, nothing of any value. It may be their hopes, their wishes, their dreams, their success, but in the end, it literally will turn into dust and nothingness. And then there's this other group of people who are devoted to the Lord, to Yahweh, the ones who have been redeemed. And what I love about this is David here isn't actually boasting that he's such a good person and he's better than everyone else. David is actually saying that what puts him in that special category is his dependence upon the Lord. Notice the contrast in the poem. He says, "I hate those who pay regard to worthless idols, but I trust in the Lord." David doesn't actually cite his works as meriting him some type of special protection from God, but his faith, the fact that he depends on the Lord. Friends, I want you to know that whether or not you feel that your performance is running at 100%, if you feel hunted down, you have refuge in God Almighty because he has redeemed you, not because you worked it up or earned it. It is faith, as we've seen in Romans over and over again, that makes one right with God. And then he says, "I will rejoice." Notice how the declaration of dependence is now turning into an affirmation or experience of assurance. He says, verse 7, "I will rejoice and be glad in your steadfast love, your covenant love, your committed love, because you've seen my affliction. You've known the distress of my soul. And you have not delivered me into the hand of the enemy. You have set my feet in a broad place." Isn't this great, friends? David actually takes some time to reflect back on all the other times that God has gotten him through, all the other times that he's protected him and provided for him. And he says, "I'm just going to rejoice in your steadfast love, your covenant love. The fact that you not only bail me out, but you see me in my affliction." Friends, some of you suffering so silently right now, hear me well. God sees you. And let me take it a step further. If the text is right, he says, "You have known the distress of my soul." Hear me. Christ feels you. It's one thing for someone to see you suffering. It's another thing to know if they can be sympathetic. Have they been there? Do they know what it's like? Friends, we have a high priest who is not untouched with the feeling of our infirmities. He knows our weaknesses. He knows what it is to feel hunted down. And he is with us. He has delivered us. He knows the distresses of our soul. And because of that, like, we can actually exclaim in retrospect, like, all these times I've experienced the same kind of pressure in the past. You delivered me, though, in those times. You rescued me. You've brought me to, it says, a broad place. You've set my feet in a broad place. You know what it's like to be in a narrow place. Uncomfortable, tight. I actually think what he has in mind more than like a rock and a hard place, like we would typically think, is probably like a high place. And, you know, mountains are, they're pretty high. And the higher you go, the more unsafe you feel. And the other crazy thing about mountains is the higher you go, the less territory there is to stand on. What he's saying is, I get the best of both. Lord, you've brought me into your presence. You've put me in the safest spot. But where there would normally be threats associated with that, I have safe ground. It's not like I'm just standing on the edge of the rock. I'm getting the best of both in this experience. Friends, I tell you, like, if you are afflicted today, if you feel hunted down, your God. Your God hears you. You go to him for help. And like this vent of release, you will begin to feel the relief of his rescue. David starts out in despair, and he ends with the declaration of praise. That's how it works, friends. I just had dinner with some people the other night who I also love dearly, and they are always, it seems, detoxing. Detox for this, a detox for that, a juice cleanse for this or that. We've been through that phase until I had to pay for it. It's like, whoa, it's expensive to juice all these vegetables, and it takes a lot of time. I don't think I've ever made it more than 2 days through one of those. But what is our cultural obsession with detoxing? Because we know that there are some things that are harmful for us, and though some people would believe this more than others, like, you got to purge it, you got to get it out. Your body can't heal itself till you get rid of the bad. Friends, I want you to know that a declaration of dependence upon God in prayer is the way that you spiritually detox. You let it out. You release it to God. And what happens in the text, at least, is that actually like rekindles like the life of faith and strength and trust. Sometimes you admittedly are praying like in absolute feeling of despair. Like, you're not feeling assured. You are doing it by faith. Like, you're just giving it to the Lord because you know it's the right thing to do. Friends, it's the right move. The release of the burden to God is actually what enables the perspective of his assuring presence. So, assurance when hunted down. But that's not the only assurance offered through this song. There's other kinds of affliction. Verses 9 through 15 will show us assurance when torn up. So sometimes you feel hunted down. Someone's after you. Other times, you feel torn up. Maybe this is a southern phrase, but we talk about it, at least often where I was from. Man, he was tore up. It means he was messed up. Like, everything in his life was off kilter. I want you to notice as we work our way through this particular text that when I say torn up, I mean from the inside to the outside and beyond. There is, you will notice in this particular text, this inescapably connected relationship between the physical, the emotional, and the relational. If you're a visual person, imagine a Venn diagram. You've got one circle that is your feelings and your emotions, another one that is your body, and then the other one is your relationships. I want you to know, friends, it's really hard to touch the one and not touch the others. Notice the heavy overlap as he experiences this tearing within his own soul. Verse 11, because of my adversaries, I have become a reproach, especially to my neighbors, and an object of dread to my acquaintances. Those who see me in the street flee from me. I have been forgotten like one who is dead. I have become like a broken vessel, for I hear the whispering of many, terror on every side, as they scheme together against me, as they plot to take my life. But I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. My times are in your hand. Rescue me from the hand of my enemies and from my persecutors. Did you see the experience there? What I wanted you to notice, and I missed reading verses 9 and 10, is that it's bracketed by a prayer. This isn't just a lament, it's a prayer. At the end, in verse 15, he says, rescue me from the hand of my enemies. And then the verse that I missed, verse 9, go back and look up at it. Be gracious to me, O Lord, in my distress. So he's asking for grace, he's asking for rescue, and notice the problem. O Lord, for I am in distress, my eye is wasted from grief. It means that he's cried so much he can't see anymore. And he says, my soul and my body also. Notice that. Soul and body, inside and outside. And whatever is going on in his life at this point, he says that my life is spent with sorrow. I can't even cry anymore. And my years are spent with sighing, just groaning. That's all I've been doing. This is a long time, long-term threat to him. My strength fails because of my iniquity, and my bones waste away. I just want to clarify one word there in verse 10. Depending on your translation, some verses will put my strength wastes away because of my iniquity, and others will actually point out that this is just someone's inner self or disposition. The Hebrew word here is kind of vague, admittedly. But I want you to know that the emphasis of this psalm is not on sin. Like Psalm 32 that we'll look at soon, like that is about like someone feeling the effects of like a fallen world because they've brought sin on themselves. It's a tortured conscience. Here, David has been talking about his righteousness. He's talking about like trying to live a good life for God. If it is referring to iniquity, it's just referring to the general iniquity or sin that we all have. I think it's like the experience of Naomi in the book of Ruth, if you remember that. Naomi thought that God was against her, that he was cursing her because she had potentially done something wrong, even though the text actually narrates that she had done nothing wrong. She was just being faithful. But don't you feel that way sometimes? Like, I must be doing something wrong. I must be in the wrong in some way. But what I want you to note is this interplay. I mean, if you were to tell, like, your medical doctor these symptoms, they would be writing you a prescription right now. Like, what? You've been grieving this long? You feel like people are out to get you and trying to kill you? I mean, like in our own culture and context, like this is the kind of thing that is just intolerable. And yet it is the way that people feel. This isn't modern, this is ancient. Friends, I'm so grateful a few years ago to come across a book written by the vice president of Puritan Reformed Theological Seminary. His name's David Murray, and his wife is a medical doctor. And he released this little book, because he experienced like significant burnout and depression in his ministry, like had to step out of it, diagnosed. Anyway, writing in the aftermath of that, he actually publishes a little book somewhere between 80 and 100 pages titled Christians Get Depressed Too. I know this for some people is a controversial topic, but I don't think there's anything controversial about this experience. This is a Christian man. This is a believer in Yahweh. This is someone who is looking to the Lord as his hope and his righteousness. It doesn't say that he's evidently done anything wrong, and yet even in that, he still experiences this physical lowness, this emotional dryness, and this relational brokenness. Friends, it's all three. It happens. And if there is indeed something medically going on, talk to your medical provider. I am not that, but I will say this as a spiritual care provider. You are not strange, weird, off because you feel the brokenness of living in a fallen world. The most righteous man that we would say in the Old Testament, the guy who had a heart after God himself, the most popular hero of like the early 66 books of the Bible, experiences this regularly. And by the way, so did Martin Luther and so did Charles Spurgeon. So does even someone like a John Piper. I remember watching this interview at a biblical counseling conference a few years ago of Piper and MacArthur, God rest his soul, actually being at this interview in front of all these people on their experiences of depression and crisis. It was the weirdest thing because, Piper's falling to pieces. Like, he can't keep himself together. He's like, he's crying. He can't get through his words. He's just saying, like, yes, I feel this all the time. And it was so odd to watch because MacArthur's kind of staring at him, like looking at him like he's like a strange object. Almost with a disgust. And they ask him what he felt about it. He's like, I have no idea what he's talking about. You could find it online. It's funny to watch. And it illustrates, though, the differences that God, the way he wires some of us. MacArthur was a sledgehammer of an individual, very little feelings, and God used that powerfully. But Piper is someone who like overflows with passion, and so he feels things more deeply. Friends, I want you to know, if you're higher on the feeling side of things, God made you that way, and living in a fallen world hurts. Particularly here in this text, what seems to be going on is that this person is actually like having this like mental, physical breakdown because of two things. It seems like the social is what's affecting the emotional and the physical. What does the psalmist attribute it to? He says, the people that I love, the people that I know, they don't even talk to me anymore. They're like leaving me alone. Abandonment. They feel abandoned. And not only do they feel abandoned by their friends, but on top of that, they feel attacked by their enemies. There's this smear campaign going on. People are talking terribly about me, like they're running my name down. And friends, I just want you to know that, like, let's just say it for what it is. I've said it before, but I'm going to say it again. Sticks and stones may break our bones, but words, they really hurt. Isn't it interesting as you read through the Psalms to note that there are entire psalms dedicated to slander? Friends, we live in a wicked world. And they will do anything they can to shut you up or to put you down. Jesus warned of it. It's in the Beatitudes. It's like a normal part of Christian living. Blessed are you when men speak evil against you, when they revile you, when they say false things about you. Like, this is just part and parcel of the Christian life, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't hurt. And so the psalmist, what I love is what he's doing is like, he's relying on God for like all the stuff that he's feeling like on the inside. Yeah, there's physical pain and yeah, there's emotional pain, but what he's lamenting primarily is the social pain. He feels abandoned by friends, hated by enemies. Friends, can I say that there are two categories of people in this church who may be leaning in on Jesus, trusting him, following him, who I'm especially concerned about when it comes to this particular affliction. And that would be those of you who are getting old and those of you who are growing up. I'm sorry for the harsh categories. It seems rather stereotyped. But let's think about it. For those of you who are growing older, not only do you feel the physical effects of just living in a fallen world in your own body, but that keeps you from being able to get out and experience the things that you used to experience. And then it feels like people that you used to know and love don't come around anymore, and a regular experience of many in aging is their friends are long gone, and now they're lonely. Welcome to Psalm 31. You tell God about that. Sure, we as a church have an obligation to move into those spaces, but I want you to know, if you are feeling that brokenness of body, the shrinking of a relational sphere, look, that hurts. Give it to Jesus. I say the growing old, but also the growing up. For those of you who are in your teen years, moving into your 20s, as you're trying to make all kinds of decisions, I don't say this in a like top-down way, I pity you. I pity you. And here's why. Because you have access, to most reports, 8 hours a day, you have access to all kinds of critical opinions running down everything you think and feel and believe as a believer. Like, it is absolute chaos online right now in the social media sphere or whether it be in the news cycle, but you do not have the blessed privilege of disconnection. You're being evaluated on everything. I mean, you post your breakfast sandwich and it's being judged by whether people like it or not. Serious. Personally, I'm an old man at heart. I've pulled out. I can't engage in that world anymore. But I get for most of you, that's not an option. And I want you to know that when you feel like you're isolated and you're being rejected or people are being critical, like, welcome to the brokenness of the world, and please give it to Jesus. Give it to Jesus. You know, one of the things that I'm most concerned about in my own life of late, I'll be transparent, I've been on the lament train for years now, telling people, yeah, one out of every three psalms is lament. We sell on the back wall Dark Clouds, Deep Mercy, which is a book on lamenting, telling God all the things that you feel. In fact, I just bought a couple copies of the book and gave it to someone else, but I never read it. I just knew that we were supposed to lament. Here was the crazy thing. It hit me last night like a ton of bricks. Nothing will sanctify you like having to preach. I don't lament. I know that other people should lament, but I don't do it. I think in part I got messed up by reading a Puritan who was writing on the divine art of contentment, and it made it sound like if you ever complain that you're ungodly. Interestingly, not referencing any of the Psalms like this. And so I'm like, man, I just need to buck up. I just need to like get it together. I'm going to pray prayers of faith. And you know what? I just realized last night, like, it is okay to pray that, God, it is not okay. It is not okay. Don't just know that in theory. I would encourage you to actually practice that. Like, in the areas where you feel the fallenness of this world crashing in on your social life and on your physical body and on your emotions and heart, give it to the Lord. Detox. A declaration of dependence is the path to an experience of assurance. Just give it to Jesus. We just don't. We just don't. We just bottle it up or we power through. But friends, it is a broken world. I want you to know that we were not made for mortality, but immortality. And when we feel the brokenness of the world, it is our privilege to go to God and say, it should not be this way. And notice what happens when he gives it to him. We'll go to the affirmation. Verse 14. But I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. My times are in your hand. Rescue me from the hand of my enemies and from my persecutor. Notice that. I trust in you, O Lord. I don't feel my way out of it. I've faithed my way through it. Trust, friends, is not a feeling. It is a choice. God, I commit this to you. It's another way of saying, Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit. You know what he's saying here? Like, it's a similar line. My times are in your hand. God, all the times, all the seasons of life. Think of Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Time for planting and a time for reaping. A time for mourning, a time for dancing. All those times, all those seasons of life have been ordained by a good God who loves and cares for his people. And when they hurt, it's okay to tell them so. But you trust. By giving it to God, you are expressing that he is in control of it. But by holding it in, you're implying that he would have nothing to do with it. Friends, turn it to the Lord. There's a third verse of assurance. Assurance when drowned out. So we've got assurance when hunted down, when torn up, when drowned out. This is the last one, verses 16 to 20. And here the psalmist is going to pick up more on that theme of just like lies being propagated in his space. People just yelling at the top of their lungs, all kinds of things that are wrong or untrue about him or about his God. Here's the prayer. Verse 16. Make your face shine upon your servant. God, look at me with favor. You want that, right? You want God's favor. You don't want his frown. You want his favor. He's saying, God, show your favor. Save me in your steadfast love and that covenant love. Lord, I want to experience that. Oh, Lord, let me not be put to shame, for I'm calling upon you. And let the wicked be put to shame. Let them go silently to Sheol. Now, to this point, hang with me for a second. You don't really know what he's talking about. It's just a general prayer for deliverance. But you're about to hear the hint on what's actually going down. What's he so torn up about? What does he want to be vindicated from? Verse 18, let the lying lips be mute, which speak insolently against the righteous in pride and contempt. Notice what he says at the end of verse 17. I call upon you, let the wicked be put to shame. Let them go silently to Sheol. Friends, let me actually render this in a more literal way. Let them shut up on the way to hell. Dak. That's pretty heavy. How bad must it be for him to say, God, do whatever it takes to quiet the cacophony of Christlessness in this world? Do you ever feel that way? Like you just keep hearing the lies at full volume of that which is good and true and beautiful, not being in Christ, but in this world. People buying into these things. And then the things that God says are wrong, people say are right. The things that God says are right, people say are wrong. And it just seems like there is no truth in this world. I was reading another book, fascinating title. It's called The Siren's Call, and it's about the attention age in which we live in. It's not an information age, it's an attention age. Information is infinite and therefore cheap. You know what is precious and valuable? Attention. You can't multiply that. You can only focus on one thing at a time. So the author makes this allusion to the sirens. Well, if you remember from Odysseus, like he has to like actually rope himself to the mast because their voice was so alluring that it would have drawn their ship in and dashed them upon the rocks. That's one siren, the pleasantness of that which is forbidden. But then the other siren is like the ambulance siren. It's a play on words. You know what it's like? That siren, just like it starts wailing. It's only been around a couple hundred years. They may sound different in whatever country you go to, but you know it when you hear it. And what the guy is actually pointing out is we're in a world that is filled with siren calls for pleasure and siren calls for that which is a perceived emergency. And now we can no longer focus on the things that actually matter. You feel that way? I mean, what is advertising other than some attempt to say, hey, this will make your life better? It is everywhere. Even in your mailbox. Did you know? Sorry. Little stat here that should pique your interest. Did you know that people used to get letters in mailboxes? But the Postmaster General a few years ago did a study and said that only one out of every 18 pieces of mail is actually a real letter. Everything else is junk. You then got email and you're like, oh, this is the new way forward. And guess what? Junk. And now you can't even check your text message without getting junk. You can't walk in a store without being bombarded by some type of new advertisement. Like, friends, the world is just yelling at us. The author then says this, and it resonates with what David's saying here. He says, basically, the information economy in which we live, the communication economy, is like a failed state. You know what happens when the government shuts down? You get all these other power-hungry little gangs that start warring against one another because they're going to find power in some other pocket. And basically, there is no like authoritative channel of communication anymore. It's just whoever can yell the loudest and the longest. Like whether it be social media, whether it be advertising, whether it be internet, like whatever it is, we're just being bombarded with junk all the time. And here's the crazy thing. 99.999% of it is anti-God and unbiblical. It's not promoting biblical values. It's not promoting Christ as Lord. And so you understand David's cry to say, like, I'm being drowned out. I'm trying to, like, lead a nation. I want people to focus on that which matters, but there's just too much noise. God, deliver us. Shut them up. I have a prayer that I would share with you, but you're going to have to buy the book. I can't keep reading you the prayers. The author is going to, like, kill me. I'm going to reference it again. It's Every Moment Holy by George McElvey, and it's a book of prayers for ordinary, common situations, and one of my favorite in there is called A Prayer for Those Who Are Flooded by Too Much Information. Friends, I don't have time to read it. It's about 4 minutes long, but this is what David's praying. We are just flooded by too much. God, rescue me from just being drowned out. It's like everybody's got a megaphone. But here's the amazing thing. He says that God will be a safe haven to him against these schemes and against this speech. The worldly propaganda campaign will come to an end. God's people are protected from it. Notice what he says in verse 17. O Lord, let me not be put to shame, for I call upon you. Let the wicked be put to shame. Let them go silently to Sheol. Let the lying lips be mute, which speak insolently against the righteous in pride and contempt. And now notice the positive. Oh, how abundant is your goodness, which you have stored up for those who fear you and work for those who take refuge in you, in the sight of the children of mankind. In the cover of your presence, you hide them from the plots of men. You store them in your shelter from the strife of tongues. Do you see how 19 and 20 is an answer to this very thing? God gives safe haven for his people who are being inundated with, again, the cacophony of Christlessness. Like, there is rescue, there is shelter. And I would say, friends, that one of those for us is even our local church. Isn't it nice to come and be with people for a couple hours and think about that which actually matters? This is a safe haven for our souls. And can I tell you that in the modern technological world that works against you, it does some things for you? Friends, you do have a safe haven. I would recommend that you actually use a printed copy of the scriptures and a private place to pray before you ever pick up your phone in the morning. You say, oh, well, that's a little over-prescriptive. Well, so is brushing your teeth. But I think it's really good for your health, and I would commend it. In a similar way, I would say, friends, like, just if we all, could you imagine, if we all said, we will not touch our phones until we've touched our Bibles and talked to the Lord. Friends, avail yourself of that safe haven of good news. Like, keep coming to this haven that God has provided for you. Yeah, let it out in prayer. Like, declare your dependence, but also experience the assurance on the other end. Be reminded of the times that he has protected you and informed you with that which is good. And so with those three verses, the song is over, friends, and now we have the reprise. For those of you who aren't musically inclined, a reprise is when you take like a theme of the song or a part of the song and you attach it to the end and you basically like turn up the volume. Like it's like the big ending, to use the teenage language that I often hear in my house. Don't cringe, children. It goes hard. Like you feel it. Notice how this ending hits. It's so awesome. Verse 21. Blessed be the Lord. For he has wondrously shown his steadfast love to me when I was in a besieged city. I had said in my alarm, I am cut off from your sight, but you heard the voice of my pleas for mercy when I cried to you for help. Do you see it, friends? He's actually saying at the climax of this song that he is experiencing assurance amid the affliction. He said, it was when I was in, like, trapped, like in a besieged city. Now, that, for those of you who don't think this way, like, that's a city that's been surrounded. All its resources have been cut off. Probably a physical analogy would help you better. Take a string, tie it around your finger as tight as you can, and leave it there and see what happens. You cut it off from its resources, it's going to die. It's going to shrivel away. That's the experience of the psalmist in this moment. He has been cut off from every human resource for good, and yet he has called out to God in his panic, in his trouble, like he felt the distress. And what does the text say? That when I was there, you intervened. You heard my cries for mercy. You listened when I pleaded to you for help. Friends, God offers assurance to his people amid anxieties, afflictions, opposition. That's what he does. But how? How? How does he do it? And again, the refrain speaks to the practical pointer for you and me in the conclusion. Here it is. How do you experience assurance amid affliction? Look at the last verse and see. Love the Lord, all you his saints. The Lord preserves the faithful, but abundantly repays the one who acts in pride. Be strong and let your heart take courage, all you who wait for the Lord. Friends, do you notice what he's telling you to do is you look to the Lord and love him. Like when you're in the affliction, you look to the Lord and love him. That's step one. And then step two, you lean on him and live for him. Look and love, one, lean and live. Didn't we not see that pattern throughout the entire psalm? When he was in the midst of the being hunted down, what did he do? In love, he looked to the Lord. He was crying out to the Lord. And then what happened after that? He experienced assurance. He leaned in and then was able to live out like this actual intervention of God in his soul. What happened in the second one when he felt torn up? Same thing. In love, he looked to the Lord. Like he, instead of looking at his problems, he actually looked to the Lord in prayer. He leaned in on that. He was trusting the Lord, and then he was able to live out of that. The actual distress became like an opportunity for him to live it out. And then the last one, when he was drowned out with all the noise of godlessness, same thing. He looked, he loved, and then he leaned and he lived. Friends, this is really simple for us, and these are the two ways that I press this into you. When in any kind of affliction, avail yourself of the opportunity to declare your dependence upon the Lord. Look to him. Not just at the problem, but to him. I grew up singing all kinds of old hymns. One of my favorite that I don't think we've ever sang here. We're not going to sing it today, don't worry. Is I must tell Jesus. But I'm going to change it. I'm going to change the pronouns to make it more corporate. Hear this exhortation from the old hymn writer. We must tell Jesus all of our trials. We cannot bear these burdens alone. In our distress, he kindly will help us. He ever loves and cares for his own. I must tell Jesus, I must tell Jesus, I cannot bear my burdens alone. I must tell Jesus, I must tell Jesus, Jesus can help us, Jesus alone. Friends, I encourage you to listen to that song. The second verse goes on to talk about troubles and feeling friendless, and the third verse talks about temptations and trials, and the fourth verse talks about evil alluring, and it just says, I must tell Jesus. We must tell Jesus. Friends, can I just say to us that we are a people of dependence upon the Lord? Hear me, if you have entered into a relationship with God through faith in Jesus Christ, it is your normal disposition to depend upon Him. Unlike childhood, which we actually anticipate, like someone growing up into independence and doing stuff on our own, friends, we are forever the needy and dependent children of God. Faith got you in, faith keeps you in, faith will get you to the end, and not just any faith, a faith in Jesus Christ alone. By the way, a Jesus Christ who also entered into the human realm and actually took on the multitude of afflictions that the psalmist here experiences times 100. And what did he do in his moment of darkest and deepest distress? He cries out from this song. He's praying this song as he's thinking on the cross. Father, into my hand, thy hands I commit my spirit. Listen, I want to assure you of something. In David's case, under the old covenant, he experienced deliverance by actually getting out of the physical situation. But how did Jesus experience the deliverance? Through death itself and resurrection. Friends, the deliverance that we will experience won't always result in the reversal of circumstances. It may even lend itself to our physical demise. But because we trust in the one who has overcome death, we still have hope no matter how bad it gets. Friends, give it to Jesus. He's died. He's risen again. You have hope of life eternal. Declare your dependence. And then through that, as you let it out, I trust that God in His kindness will then and only then enable you to experience the assurance on the back end. Friends, I want you to know this in conclusion. God has indeed promised to save you through Christ. You are eternally secure. But hear me and hear me well. Your experience of that assurance is dependent upon your looking to Him and leaning on Him in prayer. You experience burdens and trials and struggles because you choose to carry them. You haven't released them to the Lord. You may be secure. It may all be well, but your experience of that is directly affected by your obedience and depending upon Him or your resistance and doing that in pride. I only prove it from this verse. It says, love the Lord, all you His saints. That's chesedim again, the faithful ones, the trusting ones. The Lord preserves the faithful, but abundantly repays the one who acts in pride. Oh, get your pride out of the way. Just lean in on the Lord in prayer. How do we do that, friends? We've already done it. We did it today when we gathered. As like Joseph was praying earlier today, like we lean in on that. We're praying. We're expressing our dependence as a body. When we pray together at 9 o'clock on Sunday mornings, we're expressing our dependence as a body together. When you are breaking up into these various groups as a church, like I pray and trust that you will take time in all of those. I don't care if it's an academic environment or a communal one, to like spend some significant time in prayer depending on the Lord together, and then do this individually. Not just formally in the morning, but like throughout the day. Like, God, help us release our burdens to Him so we can experience this assurance amid affliction. And I say this as we transition to communion. The only way you would ever, ever, regularly express your dependence upon Him is to delight yourself in Him as He's revealed Himself in His Son. That's why I began the service by telling you we come to a King who cares. Look, your judgment has been placed on Christ. Like, you are under His kind control and rule. Like, give your petitions and needs to Him. And even this picture that we're about to partake of together is a regular reminder of the goodness and rule of our King who cares for us. Look to Him. Lean in on Him. Let's do that together now in communion. I'll pray, we'll sing, and then we'll partake. Father in heaven, we come to you needy and dependent again. Or there are people here experiencing acute affliction. Some feel hunted down, or some feel torn up. Some actually just feel drowned out. They're just tired of living in a sinful world. Hates Jesus. No matter the experience, I pray that we'd all be able to find hope and faith, trust, as we look to you, as we release these burdens to you. And we know that you will, because you've given us your Son. You've given us the greatest gift already. How would you not give us freely all things? So remind us of that in this time of communion together. Even use this song to prepare our hearts. In Jesus' name, amen.